When I was a kid, I'd come down to the breakfast table and I'd sit down and my father would look and he said, "Oh, it's a nice shirt." And I said, "Thank you." And he would say, it's a good shirt for a day like today. I never knew what that meant. I never had a clue as to what that meant. But as I was listening to that music coming in, I said, "Well, that's good music for today."
I kind of agree with
that. Yeah, that's fine. That's good music for today. So, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to the panel discussion. I'm Joe Dunne. We have a great panel. Let me introduce everybody to you. We'll get started. We have a lot to talk about. And, we have a lot to talk about. So we'll keep it at that. We've been noticing we've been getting a lot of letters, so we're trying to incorporate as many as we possibly can. We ask you to keep them short and to the point. And I'll tell you right now, we're not going to get to all of them. We never do. We never will. There's way too many letters than there is time to do it. And also a lot of them are just very not that you're repetitive, but have been written by other people. And so we try to get the mood of the room, as it were. So I guess what I'm saying is don't take it personally. I met a couple of people over the weekend who came up and taking it very, very personally. Don't take it personally. We thank you. We welcome your letters, and we'd love to hear you, regardless, and hear what you have to say and add it to the discussion. All right, let me introduce the group to you. Partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
Taking it day by day.
Taking it day by day. Yeah, it's a good way to do it, and very nice that today included you being here, so thank you
very much.
Alexander Mihailovich is a professor emeritus of Russia at Hofstra University and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, which this is a terrific, terrific book with really describe what the mission was for that book, because you just nail it.
Well, I look at the ways in which both countries, or the conservative intelligentsia in both countries, use culture war talking points as a way of advancing an agenda that actually has very little to do with culture war and more to do with economics, but that the culture war is a very useful way of carrying a particular nationalist economic agenda of what I would call a unilateralist policy vis-a-vis the larger world, moving it forward.
And this is from people who generally, and I mean, you wrote the book, but my reading of it was from people who generally don't understand the culture war.
Yes. I think that's a charitable way of putting it. Yeah.
Well, it's just fascinating. Again, it's called Illiberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia. And it's a great pleasure to have Alexander here, as always. As it is to welcome our dear friend J.P. Miller to the program. The man is the Empire Report. He is responsible for its daily arrival, and we are thrilled to have him here. Good morning. How are you?
I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm great, and I appreciate being here, Joe.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. We really enjoy having you here, and we thank all our panelists for being so great and joining us. Okay, so we have a lot to talk about. I thought we would start with the Supreme Court decisions that came yesterday, and maybe then that'll bring us up to the time that the stock market opens, and then that'll be a perfect time to talk about the current state of our stock market. But yesterday there were two major decisions that took place. One, thank God Sienna's here, but one is that the Supreme Court overturns a lower court's block on Venezuelan transportation. So the Supreme Court ruled on Monday night that the Trump administration could continue to move on with having these Venezuelan deportations, which were initially blocked. The Supreme Court said that they were still allowed to deport Venezuelan migrants using a wartime powers act for now, overturning a lower court that had put a temporary stop to the deportations. The decision does mark a victory for the Trump administration, although the ruling did not address the constitutionality of using the Alien Enemies Act to send the migrants to a prison in El Salvador. The justices instead issued a narrow procedural ruling saying that the migrants' lawyers had filed their lawsuit in the wrong court. Oopsie. Now, let's go to the second decision that was made, also having to do with El Salvador, but the Supreme Court has temporarily blocked an order requiring the return of a wrongly departed migrant. The Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, acting on his own, issued an administrative stay, a brief pause meant to give the court time to consider the matter. The justices are expected to act in the coming days. The Chief Justice issued the stay. It came hours after the administration asked the court to block the trial judge's order instructing the government to return the migrant Kilmar Armando Abrega Garcia by 11:59 on Monday, so last night at midnight. The judge of the Federal District Court in Maryland had said the administration committed a grievous error, which they admit that it was an error, the administration, that shocks the conscience by sending Mr. Abrego Garcia to a notorious prison in El Salvador last month. So let's just pick this up real quick, this part of the story, Sienna, because here's where I'm having trouble. You made a mistake. They agree that they made a mistake after it was found out that they made a mistake. But then the first thing they say is, but we can't do anything about it. And then the judge says, yeah, well, sure there is. Yeah, you can do something about it. And then the administration goes to court and says, well, we're not going to do anything about it. And then they say, okay, well, we'll give you more time to figure this out. Now, do we read in from that the administration doesn't want this individual who is wrongly sent to El Salvador to return to the country?
You are correct. So they're trying to set a precedent here, right? If you recall, a few weeks ago, we had the Guantanamo Bay situation where they were going to place people there. That place is under U.S. control, technically, right? So it's easier to bring people back. The argument here is that the El Salvadorian detention facility is not under their control, so they can't bring people back. What they're trying to do is set a precedent, in essence. And the problem is, what the district court judge wanted was to restore the status quo. That's the whole point of an injunction. While we go through the full court proceedings, we need to bring them back and then go through the due process to determine whether he ever should have left the country in the first place.
So excuse my oversimplification of this, but if you go to the doctor and to get your right foot worked on and they take off your left leg, that's obviously an error, right? But now, they can't put necessarily the leg back, but they can certainly say, okay, this is an issue, and care as to the treatment of that individual from there on, realizing the error they made. So what is the hold up with that?
It's the question of jurisdiction. That's what it all comes down to, right, with the courts. Do we have, you know, can the court compel them to bring someone back from another country? Right. That's the underlying foundation of this whole thing. And I think you have to understand that's the whole purpose of why the Aliens Enemies Act was used, because it allowed them to extract this individual and take him straight out, extradited removal without due process. So this individual had went in front of an immigration court. They found that he was entitled to withholding of removal. And what that means is he probably didn't qualify for asylum. So they went to the next level, which is withholding of removal. He cannot be removed to El Salvador. So he was living under the supervision of the court and more than likely under the supervision of ICE. And so at that point, if they found that he was a member of this gang, what they should have done is reopened immigration proceedings and charged him with being a member of this gang, and therefore he should be removable. And then the judge would have determined whether or not he was removable at that time. That was the proper procedure that should have took place. Instead, they used the Aliens Enemies Act, took the individual right away, and removed him from the country.
So let me ask one more question, then we'll bring the rest of the group in here. But the fact that this also is, it while the situation is different because others were sent there, and were sent there at least for a reason, but we can even argue that, right?
We can even argue that. And so that's the underlying concern for the immigration community, right? If we're using the Aliens Enemies Act, what they're using as their basis, we don't know what their basis is or what their baseline is for removal from the country. And so it's a slippery slope. And so that's what's so concerning about this whole situation. And once the individual is outside the country, how do we pull them back? What is the mechanism we use if we can't use the court? And that's why everyone's watching this case so closely.
And when it comes to, and again, I realize this is an oversimplification, and I apologize for being dumb. But if you you put two bags on the
your metaphors.
you go to baggage claim, and yeah. you put two bags on the carousel. And you get your boarding pass and off you go. And then all of a sudden you're like, whoa, I left my hairdryer in there. Can I grab my hairdryer? And then usually they're like, yeah. But the idea that once it's through, there's nothing that they can do, seems to me then it's then in El Salvador's hands and not in our hands. And is that any way to have this situation dealt with?
Let me push this a little bit further, what you're saying,
okay,
without equating foreign nationals to baggage. I'm not saying that.
But no.
what if you gave...
How do I get my hair dryer back?
But what if you gave your airline two of your bags, right?
Yes.
And inadvertently, you were going to California, and inadvertently, one of your bags went to France.
Yes.
Right? And that airline had to get your bag back from France. They could do that because they have a contract with the airline and the right to operate there or what have you. That's the equivalent I would make to this situation. We have a contract with El Salvador prison facility. This should enable us to be able to work with them to get people back when there is an error. So that's where I would take that description.
Yes. Yeah. I realize it's clunky. I know that. But and then when it comes to the first case of that you can continue to have these Venezuelan deportations and the Supreme Court overturning the lower court's block, both of these, from my understanding, are temporary, correct?
Yes, they are temporary.
And so what are they waiting for? What do they hope to accomplish within that pause?
So they're going to let the lower courts adjudicate the case. That's what they want to do. But in the interim, they're going to move forward. And they did highlight, however, that they didn't bring the case in the right district. Mm-hmm. What they mean by that is, usually for habeas corpus, that's when someone has unlawful or prolonged detention. You have to bring it in the district court where the individual is being detained. These individuals were, according to the court's opinion, in Texas. This case was in D.C., mm-hmm. And so they're saying it was in the wrong court. But furthermore, they said that the habeas corpus portion of the cases, that was dismissed, that those cases weren't moving forward. And so the court said that you need to bring their detention up in the right district, and it needs to be under habeas corpus. And so that's what they were saying.
So final question before we then go to the rest of the group here, but I realize these are two separate cases, and these are very separate cases.
Yes.
But they do look at and give us an example of how deportations are currently being handled by this administration, and at this time in our country.
I mean, these cases give you an idea of what's going to happen to future deportations. So that's the first case. So in that case, the Supreme Court spoke to them needing to go through the immigration court system. You have to give them notice. What they meant by that was notice of your charges against them. They have to be in front of a judge. So that's why some immigration individuals in the community are excited about the decision, because that takes away that expedited removal aspect of it. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's for future looking, what's happening for future people that are detained. The case for the individual from Maryland, that's past looking. That's what's concerning about individuals that have already left the country. Right. Right. So what happens with that? And that's why everyone's highlighting that, because we want to know, do we have jurisdiction to bring them back?
We will take a break. When we come back, we will hear from our other panelists, and we'll welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Our first stories this morning having to do with Supreme Court rulings that came down late yesterday, both having to do with deportations. One, the Supreme Court overturning a lower court block on Venezuelan deportations, and the other, having the court temporarily block an order to return a man who was wrongly deported to El Salvador. We have talked to Sienna about that, and I'd like to bring in our other panel members and welcome your letters as well, panel at WAMC.org. Alex.
Well, all of this reminds me of this famous quotation by Stalin. Give me the person and I'll find the appropriate article from the criminal code with which to convict them. This has an element of that. It's this kind of almost legalistic improvisation. And as we were discussing during the break, you know, the thing that's distinctive about the Aliens Enemy Act from 1798 it really applies to people who come from countries with which the United States is at war. And that's not the case here. I mean, we're not at war in any kind of formal or even figurative sense with any of the countries from which these people come. And, you know, so it's all very kind of makeshift, you know, their whole way of doing this, you know. I mean, they're just it's a little bit of a strategy of throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what's going to stick.
JP?
Well, I have some questions for Sienna, more questions. I apologize. But Sienna, I believe that these are the most significant Supreme Court cases where they have come out with somewhat of a decision since Trump has taken office for the second time. And I wonder from your perspective, as you read these decisions and you look at how the different justices, you know, are navigating this, how do you view their decisions? Are they more, you know, against the Trump administration or with the Trump administration than you would have thought?
I think that they're more against a little bit, just by a fraction. And when I say that, I'm highlighting the fact that they are reinforcing the need for an individual to go through the immigration court proceedings, right? And I think that's one of the most important parts of this whole two cases, is that it's so important that you're able to go through immigration court, because that way you can discuss your charges, you can contest your charges, and then when you remove someone, it's after a thorough due process hearing. And the fact that they're enforcing that rather than allowing expedited removal is a big deal, because what the Trump administration does not want to do, and we've seen that in the last few weeks, is put more immigration judges, hire more immigration judges. They've been laying off immigration judges. They don't want a backlogged court system. Also, if they have to house people and detain people here in the U.S., a lot of money. They don't want to put that money there as well. And so that's what's very interesting about it, is that it's easier and less expensive, even though that El Salvadorian facility is pretty expensive, to just get people out of the country as fast as possible rather than have to house them in detention facilities. And so I think it's more against them because it pushes the individuals, the foreign nationals, through the immigration court process.
I know JP has other questions for you, but just a quick follow-up to the question that he just asked. Should we read anything into the fact that this was, in this one ruling, the Chief Justice's ruling alone.
And you're referring to the Maryland?
Yes.
I think, no, not necessarily, because I think what's happening there is he just issued a stay so that the court could continue to adjudicate. It's concerning for me that they didn't feel the urgency in that case because someone is detained outside the U.S. And it's a huge deal. But I'm not reading into that, and it's hard to read a tea leaves with Justice Roberts.
And so as you read it, you know, when you read like the New York Times, it says it's a victory for the Trump administration. But when I ask you the question, you kind of say, well, it's technically a victory. But as you look at what these justices are saying and how they're deciding, it's giving an indication of how they're going to go moving forward, which is to be potentially antagonistic with the Trump administration on this. Is that uniform across the left and the right justices, or are there, or, you know, like I noticed that Amy Coney Barrett sided with the with the more progressive justices. What did you make of that?
They all agreed about the court system aspect of it. They all agreed that individuals had the right to notice and to go through the immigration court proceedings. And to me, that was the highlight. But what you saw was some people, you saw, you know, Justice Jackson kind of concerned about how fast it went, us doing using the shadow the emergency docket process and things like that. So that's where you saw them kind of depart on about how fast it went or whether they should have adjudicated more. But for the most part, to me, as an immigration attorney, our clients need, their families need that time for them to be placed in immigration court so we can find them and we can help adjudicate what's going on. If people are allowed to be picked up and removed right away, then that's when you hear the kidnapping and what's going on. It's that level of fear. So we need that time in immigration court. And that's why most of the individuals in the immigration community were happy with the justice standing on that importance.
And one more thing, which is there is a school of thought that it's possible that the Trump administration would potentially just ignore what the Supreme Court says to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so is there indications that they can or will ignore how the Supreme Court has interpreted these cases, or from what you've seen, that they are going to comply with the framework that the Supreme Court sets up for them?
In my personal opinion, I'm very concerned about compliance. And what happens if they issue a decision contrary to what they want, whether they'll even bring them back, whether they'll bring in individuals back, whether they will continue to enforce the way they are, whether they will not issue charging documents to foreign nationals who have been ordered to be removed from the country. So I'm very concerned about that.
And one other thing, you know, during the break, we were talking a little bit about the person that is in the El Salvadorian prison and about, can you explain about how it's not an El Salvadorian that's in the El Salvadorian prison? If they just are simply released from prison and left there, that doesn't really puts them in a better spot, but not where they want to be.
Exactly. So what typically happens when someone's removed why it's so important that you get removed to your home country is because when you're removed to your home country, the idea is that you would get some sort of due process in your home country, right? Mm-hmm. And so you would be able to, if they detained you, someone could advocate that there should be a hearing or what have you to determine whether or not he was really a gang member, and that person may eventually be released. The problem is that when you're in another country, the only rights you have, if you ever traveled abroad, is you have to, I don't even know if they're notifying the consulate, or is there a consulate from their home country there that can advocate on their behalf? So it brings up all sorts of issues when you're in a different country and you're locked up and there's no consulate representative from your home country, then they can just keep you there, especially if the U.S. is paying for you to be there, right? So they have a strong incentive to keep you there. And so we're not familiar with the due process rights there. And so that's what's so concerning as well. And I would like to note that, you know, it is a slippery slope. What if a naturalized U.S. citizen got wrapped up in this and they were taken there? What would that look like? We don't want it to go there. But, I mean, those are the implications we're thinking of long term.
Linda writes in and says, could it be that the detainee sent to El Salvador has been tortured and is already dead and the U.S. doesn't want to admit it?
Well, Linda, purportedly, because, right, what the administration is saying is that they're unable to have access to these individuals. So they don't know what type of care these individuals are being given. And we don't know whether they're allowed to call family members. This is not the U.S. They don't have a right to an attorney necessarily or any of those other rights. So we don't know.
I will say that Linda's question was something that, as we were talking about this over the last 12 hours, that was a question that kept coming up just in conversation of is that, you know, could that be a reason? And certainly is a somewhat obvious question, so I'm glad Linda brought it to us. Layla says the administration sent a man targeted for torture to a prison where torture is the norm, so why don't they want to bring him back? I'm afraid the real answer is that Mr. Obrego Garcia has been tortured to within an inch of his life or worse, already killed and buried in an unmarked grave. Let's hope one of the justices asked the direct questions of the Solicitor General whether the man is still alive and watch him squirm. Although the cruelty is always the point, the cowards in the so-called government don't want the truth to come out for all to see.
Can I just highlight the fact that what happens typically, if a home country, if someone's removed from the country and their home country does not accept them, right, then typically they remain here in the U.S. and we deal with habeas corpus, prolonged detention, we go through that process. But if this precedent is allowed to stand, then that stateless individual or the person who can't go home will be sent to El Salvador. That's they will have this place to send people when they have difficulties returning someone to their home country, or if there's a delay in returning someone to their home country. And sometimes this happens, and because someone was born in that country, but they came very young. There's no proper documentation that they're a citizen of that country, and so now they're stateless. So, you know, this has very, 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 very strong implications.
Paul says, I love the argument that they, quote, can't bring Mr. Obrego back. Kristi Noem, the cabinet secretary in charge of the ICE division that sent him to El Salvador, actually visited the prison while he was there. So that means she could have brought him back on her plane. I don't know that was the timing such that we knew at that point that he was there erroneously. I'm not sure on that, but
I feel like it was working through litigation probably by then.
Then we go to Ken. The Trump administration used millions of dollars to pay the president of El Salvador to accept deportees. Surely the same method can be used to have them returned. Then, Thomas, why do we not know more about why Trump is in Putin's pocket? Oh, would you like that one, Alexander?
I guess. I think that without going too much into the weeds of Trump's, you know, initial contacts with the Soviet Union, I think that he thought that there would be a kind of a golden pot at the end of the rainbow in real estate terms for him to expand his Trump brand within the last 2 years of the Soviet Union and throughout the 90s. He was very frustrated by many of the real estate restrictions within China. Initially, he looked there to expand his real estate empire in terms of his hotel brand. But then subsequently, he thought, well, it's just too complicated there. I'll never be able to work with them. And so essentially, members of the Putin administration have been kind of dangling that carrot for him as something that could happen at some point. And there's evidence of this, you know, from 2013 when Trump was in Moscow for the Miss Universe concert, competition that he was, you know, being wooed in that respect. But I think that's somehow not a very productive line of inquiry. Is I think more to the point would be that Trump has a kind of what he perceives to be a temperamental affinity with Vladimir Putin. He actually faulted Mikhail Gorbachev during the last few years of the Soviet Union for not cracking down on protesters violently enough. He thought that Gorbachev was a weak leader precisely because of that. And he admires Putin for his anti-democratic policies and tactics.
We'll pause there. We want to move on to other topics. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll take a quick break and be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Alexander Mihailovich, and we welcome J.P. Miller to the program this morning, and we thank you all for being here. So what would a 9:30 half hour be without talking about the stock market and where we are at this moment? The big discussion that we're having is in regards to the fallout from last Wednesday's announcement regarding tariffs and the turmoil that that caused and is causing. Now, most of the markets are up at the moment, but what we'll talk about is cracks appearing among Trump's cheerleaders amid the market turmoil, because any way you look at it, the market still is in turmoil. As the world reels from President Trump's trade war, J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon is alerting shareholders that the tariffs will slow down growth. Podcaster Ben Shapiro is warning that the president's vision of international trade is mistaken, and Senator Ted Cruz is advising that the tariff strategy carries, quote, enormous risk. Trump's tariffs are increasingly alienating some of the corporate titans, influencers, and even Republican lawmakers who served as his boosters as the president plows ahead with a trade strategy that has prompted wild swings in the markets. The criticism is an early sign that the economic turmoil caused by his trade war could leave lasting political scars for Trump, who doubled down on the strategy by threatening new tariffs against China on Monday morning. That from the Washington Post. The chiding marks a departure from the general acquiescence among Trump's allies during the first 2.5 months of his shock and awe presidency. JP.
It's been an interesting time in the stock market, to say the least, over the last couple of days. What I find of note is that there are zero business leaders out there saying, hey, these tariffs are a good idea. Mm-hmm. Not a single business leader is going on CNBC and saying that they're a good idea. Even people within his own orbit, Elon Musk, who you would say is more than just in Trump's orbit, he's a key advisor to Trump, is out there criticizing Trump on the tariffs, which is remarkable. You know, you never see Elon Musk criticize Trump about anything. He is now criticizing the tariffs. Basically, the person in Trump's orbit that is really advocating for the tariffs that I can see is Howard Lutnick and Peter Navarro. If I was president of the United States and I had Peter Navarro and Howard Lutnick arguing on one side and Elon Musk and every other business leader in America arguing on the other side, I would go with Elon Musk and every other business leader. But Trump so far is going with Lutnick and Navarro. The tariffs are scheduled to go in at midnight, and what you see in the stock market today is it's up about 3%. There are the bulls and the bears right now, and the bulls are believing that the market's going up, and the bears are believing that the market's going down. And the bears say if Trump is going to follow through on this, there's going to be increased tariffs, there's going to be increased prices on consumers, there are going to be tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of layoffs by major corporations, FedEx, Amazon, Walmart, and we're going to go into a recession. The bulls' case is not that those is basically that Trump is bluffing and that he is going to not implement these tariffs over the long term and that he is going to make deals.
Well, just to follow up on that comment, JP, about the bull, you know, the bulls, you know, who are assessing, you know, this damage. The reason why they were guardedly optimistic was that there was a rumor that Trump was going to put a hold on the tariffs.
90 days.
Yes, which turned out not to be true. So, in other words, this slight uptick in the market is largely illusory. I mean, it's not illusory in the sense that it's you know, it actually happened, but the reasons for the response have nothing to do with something that is actually unfolding in terms of a change of the tariff policy.
If I live to be 375, I'll never understand the markets fully, but or at all. But that kind of thing can have an impact, a rumor, whereas the president doubling down and saying there's going to be more tariffs on China, you would think would have. you would think, which is real, mm. you would think would have a detrimental effect.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. One would think.
Where that has not been the case over the last 12 to 18 hours.
What I would say is, even though he is threatening right now more tariffs on China, what the market really reflects is the sentiment of investors. And so him actually following through on even more tariffs on China, investors, in my opinion, the sentiment is that they don't believe that he is talking a big game, but he will not follow through on that. And even if he does follow through on it, it will be temporary. He may allow the tariffs to go on at midnight and may let them go on for a couple of weeks or whatever. But I believe the sentiment with the market going up is that he will eventually relent. That can change on a minute's notice. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I was watching the stock market. I should have been focused on work, but I was watching the stock market. And so in the morning, I turn it on. It's minus 5%. Mm-hmm. I go back an hour or two later. It's plus 2%. Mm-hmm. I go back. It's minus 3%. Then it's up 50 basis points, down 50 basis points. So just because it's up right now at the market open, with 3%, we are going to see, as long as there is not clarity, which we have no clarity now. As long as there's not clarity and confidence in the market of what the plan is going forward, you're going to see a lot of volatility to the upswings and the downswings. And I would argue that those downswings, there are going to be more to come. People that think that, now I'm not a market investor or anything like that, but people that say, oh, the market's up, oh, that's all behind us. You could see significant drops in the market. Overall, the market is down 11.6% year to date. That is a significant drop, but in historical context, for a year, you could see a minus 11% drop and not be totally swayed by it. But his actions, I think what the market is concerned about are drops of 20% and 30%. That drop over Thursday and Friday was the largest two-day drop since COVID, when people thought that the world was going to end. And you're going to continue to see volatility. And again, he does not have any allies in business that are advocating for his position. These are people that donated millions of dollars, wanted to see him elected. You think about people like Zuckerberg, Bezos, and the CEO of Google, who are all up there at his inauguration. They've all been hit with tens of billions of dollars to their net worths over 2 days.
Yeah.
So this is going to be interesting, and it's certainly a big gamble by Trump. An economic slowdown is a bonanza for the Democrats in the midterms. If there is an economic slowdown and a recession, which J.P. Morgan is now predicting, you could see 50, 75 seats lost by the Republicans in the House. You could see 10, 15, 20 Senate seats lost if there's a significant recession. And what Trump has to worry about is, okay, if I lose 10, 15 seats in the U.S. Senate, I can get impeached and then they can convict. He is certainly a risk taker, and this is a big gamble on his part and ill-advised, according to the entire business community.
I'm struck by the contrast between Trump 2 and Trump 1, these two administrations, because in comparison with the present moment, during Trump 1, he was exquisitely attuned to what was going on in the market. He wanted, in some sense, the economic policies to be manifest concretely in the market and sort of, positive developments there. He was positioning himself at that time truly as Calvin Coolidge, in some sense, as, the president who said the business of America is business. Now, all of that seems to be out the window. You have misinformation and confused economic theory coming from the upper levels of the White House. Navarro, the so-called China hawk, who's the most aggressive person advising him vis-a-vis economic relations with China, recently made up an economic expert to clarify his theories about China, a completely fictional so-called expert. This is in some ways new territory. I'm really, kind of flabbergasted by this, and that he's taken this completely different turn in some ways from his first administration.
I agree with both of what you guys are saying. And just from a legal perspective, I heard there's been reporting that there's going to be some litigation about this as well, because technically Congress has the right to regulate trade and make taxes. And what they're saying is the use of the Emergency Powers Act of 1977 was unconstitutional. So I expect that if nothing happens in the next couple of days, we'll see some litigation about this as well to figure out whether it was constitutional what he did with these tariffs.
Yeah, we'll take a break there. Top of the hour, we'll go to news and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. We have a great panel this morning. Santa Freeman Tolbert is here, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Alexander Mihailovich is here, professor emeritus of Russia at Hofstra University and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia. And the Empire Report's J.P. Miller joins us. We are very happy to have you with us. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org to get your letters in over the next 50 minutes or so. Let's go to another story and see what else we can try to dissect, figure out, as it were. So this will, having to do with Russia, so we'll start with Alexander on this, but in Odessa, many wonder about the benefits of a Black Sea ceasefire with Russia. Ukrainian Navy officers and business owners in the port city pondered what Kyiv could gain from a truce after it pushed back Russian vehicles and resumed commercial shipping. The Ukrainian Navy patrol boat zipped across the Black Sea, its double-barrel 25-millimeter machine gun locked on the horizon. The enemy, Russia, was nowhere in sight, yet ever present. In the command room, the captain and his crew scanned screens showing color-coded zones marking Russian mine-laden waters and red arrows tracking drones prowling the area. The crew's mission was to defend the waters off Odessa, Ukraine's largest Black Sea port city, and keep them safe for commercial traffic. It has been grueling work clearing Russian mines by day, shooting down drones by night. But after more than a year of patrols alongside the Ukrainian Navy vessels, they have succeeded. The Russian Navy has been pushed far from Ukrainian shores, allowing Ukraine's commercial shipping to rebound to near pre-war levels. On Tuesday, the fruits of the efforts materialized on the horizon, the silhouette of a 740-foot Panama-flagged ship gliding toward a Ukrainian port to be loaded with grain. What should we take from this development?
So I think one very important aspect of the entire conflict in Ukraine, I mean, Russia's war on Ukrainian territory and assault on the sovereignty of the country, one very important aspect of it is economics, it seems to me. There's been a lot of talk, of course, about the nationalist dimension of this, that the Russian apologists or advocates for the invasion say that Ukrainians and Russians are brothers, they shouldn't be separated. It's our sphere of influence, Ukrainian territory. All of that is true as far as it goes, but so much of this has to do with access to the Black Sea and portage in the Black Sea. The interesting thing is, you would think, why argue against a ceasefire in the Black Sea? Surely this would not be in Ukraine's interests. But as it turns out, Ukraine has been able to carve a path for its ships to dock in Odessa as a result of pushing back militarily against the Russian Navy. Now the Russian Navy in the Black Sea is largely confined to the east. And so you have this wide corridor which enables Ukraine to export its goods, which at the moment are almost entirely wheat. All right. Ukraine is one of the great, even now during the war, one of the great producers of wheat, much of which, by the way, goes to the Middle East. If the ceasefire in the Black Sea were to be lifted, what you would have essentially is a renewed battle for those corridors for shipping for both the Russian Federation and Ukraine. And that would be, from the point of view of Ukraine, an absolute disaster. You would have the possibility or open up the possibility of the Russian Federation creating its own corridors for shipping and renewing its attacks on Odessa that would essentially provide an impetus to sort of capture the whole Odessa province. And that way, Russia would essentially have the entire Black Sea coast within its jurisdiction. I just want to sort of go very briefly back. You have to think a little bit about history here, because so much of the present day conflict, it seems to me, really resonates with the Crimean War in the middle of the 19th century, which also was all about nominally, we are very concerned about all of those Orthodox, East Orthodox Christians who are in the Crimean Peninsula that, you know, might be, harassed or killed by the Ottoman Empire. Right. But in fact, this was all about access, fuller access for the Russian Empire of trade routes in the Black Sea, because actually Russia was going through a significant recession in the 1840s and the 1850s. There's a whole other dimension of this, which is very important. I'll just very quickly point out that a lot of this had to do with the moral and economic failure of serfdom, which was essentially slavery. And it was a very inefficient way of generating income for the economy in comparison with American slavery, which was basically capitalism on steroids, partly because of the Whitney cotton gin. From a capitalist point of view, serfdom, which generated the whole economic system for the Russian Empire, was an absolute failure. And so Russia was looking for new ways to expand its economic reach, and they were using the excuse of a kind of a culture war in the 1850s to make this possible. Right? I see something very similar happening right now with this whole conflict. The Russian Federation wants now to expand its economic reach. And from the point of the Ukrainians, the ceasefire would be a disaster. All right. They now they've wrested control of those economic trade corridors in the Black Sea. And so obviously they would like to keep that.
So I want to check in and hear from the other members of the panel, but given the disastrous meeting that took place in the White House between Zelensky and President Trump, what has been accomplished in the relationship building since that time, and where roughly are we right now? Do we know fully?
Between Zelensky and Trump?
Correct.
Things seem to be kind of at a standstill right now because one of the things that's happening is that Trump is aiming for he's aiming for the Peace Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize, because he wants to be the one who was credited with ending the war in Ukraine. And he's been quite open about this.
Oh, yeah.
But the problem is that the Russian Federation has not been honoring the ceasefire that's on land. They've repeatedly broken it. All right. They haven't even initially there was a sense of, well, we are not going to attack energy facilities within Ukraine, so we're keeping to the letter of the agreement. But in fact, they didn't even do that. So Trump is actually very peeved with Putin right now because he's looking at Putin and he's seeing somebody who is an impediment, a kind of a living impediment to his own future glory. So that is one dimension of this. I think that it's important to always to bear in mind the kind of the personal grudges and preoccupations of Trump, because that is a part of his style of governance.
Can I just insert really quick, when you talk about where we stand right now, I can just say in the immigration field, what we're seeing is individuals who came from Ukraine and were entered on parole or what have you, all of their applications have been stopped.
Yeah.
And it's, and the excuse is they're pending further security vetting, but it feels like a sort of pseudo penalty, you know, to the Ukrainian government or what have you. And it really speaks to our relationship with the Ukrainian government right now.
Right. So just to build on that comment, that comment observation of yours, Sienna, one thing that happened yesterday that was sort of peculiar is that the Trump administration apologized to the Ukrainians who are here legally because he was going to send them back. I mean, the administration was going to send them back to Ukraine.
Yes.
Now, this is especially a problem for the younger men who are within, in the U.S. from Ukraine, because once they get back, they will be drafted, you know. And so, but there are also other concerns, because many of the Ukrainians come from parts of the country that are, you know, significantly under bombardment by the Russian Federation. They obviously don't want to go back there and, you know, subject themselves and members of their family to that risk, level of physical risk again. But my question is, and you would know more about this than I do, it seems to me that this was a very strange, hollow gesture. Yes, you apologize to them, but are you allowing them... Are you giving them further guarantees that they can stay? Are you, in some sense, opening up the door for them to bring family members, you know, over here as well, you know, to sort of extract them from, you know, situations of, you know, bodily harm? What's your sense of that?
No, I don't think that's what's happening at all. They haven't reinstated that parole program. It's still closed down.
Yeah.
For the same reasons, for security vetting, and they said they've closed that parole program down. And so now what we're seeing in practice, despite their apology, is that we're seeing longer processing times, if any processing time at all, for those applications. And these are individuals that came from Ukraine, have filed asylum applications, other visas, and they're trying to move forward with their life, and everything feels like it's stopped.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. The other aspect of this, of course, is that many of them come from parts of Ukraine which are now technically ruled by Russia. There are four regions that have been annexed by the Russian Federation completely illegally. And, you know, for them to go back to Ukraine and end up in those regions, which they might have to go to, say, to sort of, you know, take care of members of their family, this is a very, you know, dicey proposition for them, obviously. So, again, it seems to me like so much of Trump's policy vis-a-vis Putin and Ukraine, so much of it is performative. You know, we apologize. This is a kind of a verbal gesture. I'm angry at Putin, you know. Last week, this is like Trump,
exactly.
You know, but it means nothing in terms. I mean, as far as I can tell, so far it means nothing in terms of concrete policy.
And just one more thing, and I would say it's very difficult when you're filing asylum and trying to make the claim that someone's faced persecution, and that you have to make the claim whether or not the government will protect them. You're trying to prove this up to the U.S. federal government,
right.
And when their position is contrary to that.
Yeah.
That's a very hard. It's a very hard.
One last thing I would like to add here, you know, we're speaking about the tariffs earlier. One country that has a very dramatic trade deficit with the United States is the Russian Federation. We export to the Russian Federation right now, even under the sanctions, about $500 million worth of commodities. The Russian Federation exports here let me see what the figure is exactly. It is $3 billion. All right. So using the Trump administration's own algorithm, you know, we should be tariffing the Russian Federation 42%, right? What tariffs are we imposing on them now? Nothing.
What do we send them?
So we send them mostly, seems to me, it's a kind of a range of you know, like sort of small commodities, all right? Manufactured goods, all right? what the Russian Federation sends us is fertilizers, nuclear fuel, specifically in the form of refined plutonium and uranium, and some metals, right? And the Trump administration is very keen on that because the fertilizer is that they're selling us is relatively inexpensive, and it's something that he can use to appeal to the farming constituency among his voters.
Yeah.
Right. So in comparison, what we're sending them is, from what I understand, it's like different like electronic devices, you know, other small manufactured goods, things like that.
Is there anything else you want to ask? Okay. Let's go to another topic. And as we work our way through the stories of today, we welcome your letters to panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And as I wrestle with a laptop that is not being communicative at the moment, I will tread water. There we go. Excellent. I want to also talk about what happened yesterday as far as in the Oval Office, where the president sat with Benjamin Netanyahu, and Trump says the U.S. is having direct talks with Iran over a nuclear deal. And I think that was something that was maybe not initially expected, but he announced that the U.S. is to hold direct talks with Iran in a bid to prevent the country from obtaining obtaining an atomic bomb, while also warning Tehran of dire consequences if they fail. Sitting beside Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu in the Oval Office, Trump indicated that discussions would start this coming weekend, though he also implied communications had already begun. He said the talks were happening in an effort to avoid what he called the obvious, an apparent reference to U.S. or Israeli military strikes against the regime's nuclear facilities. We're having direct talks with Iran, and they've started. It'll go on Saturday. We have a very big meeting, and we'll see what can happen, he told reporters. This is Trump. Quote, and I think everyone agrees that doing a deal would be preferable to doing the obvious, and the obvious is not something that I want to be involved with, or, frankly, that Israel wants to be involved with if they can avoid it. So we're going to see if we can avoid it, but it's getting to be very dangerous territory, and hopefully those talks will be successful, and I think it would be in Iran's best interest if they are successful. A lot of words there. You can pick out what you wish.
Well, I think it's an interesting time. You know, Netanyahu has emerged, in my view, as one of Trump's key allies around the world. He knows that when he brings him to the Oval Office, there's not going to be any embarrassing back and forth. They're going to be smiling and glad handing in front of the cameras. And also Netanyahu has seen in Trump someone who has been, you know, a staunch ally of Israel. In terms of, you know, what I thought was interesting is the tariffs. I think Trump did try to put a significant tariff on Israel. And the word is that Israel tried to have potentially a zero tariff deal and that may have been rejected by Trump. Now, that's what we know publicly. What they talked about behind the scenes is, of course, potentially something different. But you can see how at especially volatile time for the president to have Netanyahu in the Oval Office as the markets are going crazy. They were, I believe, trying to put out an image of stability and two leaders that have similar interests, certainly in foreign policy.
Mm. Alex?
Well, I think yeah, there's not a great deal I have to add to that, except to say also that I think both Netanyahu and Trump see themselves as being in parallel situations. They're staying in power in many ways in order to avoid legal repercussions. So I think that's a very important aspect of this. I think another aspect, of course, is the ways in which Israel is central to so many American conservatives' understanding of what the U.S.'s role in the world should be. And I think, people have, spoken about this in sort of all sorts of terms, but I think, in regard to specific issues in American politics, but I think we need to always bear in mind the centrality of white evangelical Protestant support for Israel. This is actually very important because of the ways that they see, an ascent in Israel as interlocking with their understanding of what the future of humanity will be, specifically in terms of the prophecies of the Book of Revelation. And according to the way they read that part of the Bible is that the ascendance of Israel will be in some ways, in some sense, kind of the next step or the step before, the penultimate stage of the end times. So they're very interested in bringing that about. It's nothing to do with any kind of genuine philo-Semitism. It has to do with this very specific understanding of world politics in terms of theology. And the other aspect of this, of course, is that this has led to all sorts of kind of very awkward encounters between Americans and Israelis. Many Americans, such as Mike Huckabee, who's a Christian, evangelical Christian, sees fit to lecture any number of Israelis about what their policies should be. It's a form of goisplaining, which is very awkward and tone deaf. And I think we need to acknowledge this part of Trump's support among Americans as playing this kind of disproportionate role disproportionate role in policies vis-a-vis Israel.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear from Sienna, and then we'll go to your letters and move on to other topics as well as we finish out our time together on the roundtable panel this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Keep them short and to the point, and we can get to as many as we possibly can. In the meantime, we'll go over to hear a few words and also get the latest news from BBC. Yeah, look at that. It works. See? Santa said during the break, I want to cue Rob and bring the show back. And boom, it worked. Perfect. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the roundtable. And we are thrilled you are with us. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert is here, Alexander Mihailovich, and J.P. Miller. We have been talking about Ukraine and Russia, and specifically, about the Russia-Ukraine war, and also about a Black Sea ceasefire with Russia. Sienna, anything you'd like to add about that?
I was going to add, in terms of the Netanyahu meeting that they had, what we saw.
That's right. We're talking about Iran now.
Yeah.
My apologies. I'm sorry. I when I ceded control of the show to.
I know. I should have brought it back and did the intro. Pass me the paper, Joe.
Well, clearly you're paying more attention to this than I am. Go ahead, Sienna. Thank you.
What I was thinking about as we discussed this, and what we thought about in the immigration community when we saw it, was what's going on at higher education institutions where individuals who are on student visas are being revoked because their beliefs are seen as contrary to U.S. interests, and most of them for participating in the Palestinian protests. So seeing Netanyahu in the White House for a second time, I think it was a signal to all these individuals out there who are feeling that their visa may be revoked. It's a reminder that this may happen and that this is who we're aligned with, and protesting against this alignment is a problem.
Yeah. I mean, I just wanted to ask a question, Sienna, about specifically, this, well, also the importance of optics for the Trump administration, that they're sort of breaking bread, you know, more visibly, you know, with their Israeli allies. I mean, the, everybody recalls the case of the Columbia graduate Mahmoud Khalil, who mm-hmm. was arrested and right. and deported, or I guess he's in, still in Louisiana at
yeah,
the moment.
Yeah, he might be. I think he might be in Louisiana.
Yeah. Yeah, but the interesting thing about that is that he was arrested and taken to the facility under a law. Correct me if I'm wrong, which is all about material support for a foreign terrorist organization.
Correct.
Now, the thing here is that the wording of the law is material support is manifest in any. It's clearly defined as any property, tangible or intangible, or service, including currency or monetary instruments or financial securities, financial services, lodging, training, expert advice or assistance, safe houses, et cetera, all these kind of concrete, really quite tangible for the most part, means of supporting a so-called foreign terrorist organizations. That's the basis of the law. But it's not clear that he did any. I mean, as far as I know, he wasn't involved in any activity of that nature. It was all completely, you know. I mean, he was a spokesperson. You know, one can agree or disagree with him. He was also designated formally by Columbia. And here, I should full disclosure, as I mentioned last time, I'm a Columbia alumnus. But he was delegated by the president's office of the university to be a kind of a go-between between the administration and the protesters. So it's a very peculiar situation that he is being disciplined all of a sudden by the university for an activity that they allowed and acknowledged officially. And then he was prosecuted under a law that doesn't seem to apply to him. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, let's be very clear. First of all, he wasn't prosecuted, right? That's, that's criminal language, right?
Yeah, right?
He was charged
rather,
with removability, which is civil. And I think that's the important piece here is that it's a civil, and he's going to have the right to go in front of immigration court, and they're going to have to make that argument in order for him to remain here in the U.S. But I think if he was charged criminally for it, that's a different conversation,
right?
And that's a higher burden of proof. And so that's what's so interesting about that case. And what you find in most of these individuals, they're all, you know, some of them are PhDs or students. And if you have the funds to study here in the U.S. and you get charged with something like this, you're more likely to just leave the U.S. rather than litigate this situation or, you know, go through immigration court, remain detained the whole time. I mean, it takes a lot of tenacity to fight these charges when your other option would be just leaving and going back to your home country and, you know, being free there. And so part of that strategy is keeping one detained during this during these procedures that are taking a long time to encourage individuals to leave.
I want to remind you that you can certainly check in. We'd love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have about 15 minutes or so and a couple more topics that I would like to get to during this morning. And let me see if I actually can do that. Peter's being pokey this morning, and I don't know exactly why, but I'll worry about it later. If anyone has a story you want to tell? No, here we go. Okay. anything you want to bring up, it's all good. One of the things that I wanted to talk about is this idea of when it comes to DEI and ICE. Trump is using federal grants as leverage, and I thought that this was an interesting way of doing this. And we've been talking about, obviously, deportation. We've been talking about ICE this morning. And during President Trump's first months in office, officials in his administration have used the threat of withholding federal funding to bend institutions and municipalities to their ideological will. That strategy shows no sign of abating. The Department of Homeland Security is reviewing billions of dollars in grants for cities and states to make sure recipients comply with Mr. Trump's priorities on immigration enforcement and diversity programs. Now, grant beneficiaries must, quote, honor requests for cooperation such as participation in joint operations, sharing of information, or requests for short-term detention of an alien pursuant to a valid detainer, according to the terms and conditions for grants distributed by the department. That seems like a hell of an add-on. But the terms and conditions, which were first released last October and quietly updated in late March, also mandate that those who receive grants will provide access to detainees, such as when an immigration officer seeks to interview a person who might be a removable alien. I see it as the beginning of a reshaping of our national emergency management infrastructure, said Mark Gerarducci, who previously served as California State Emergency Services Director. Now it will be based upon ideology versus what is the actual need. Sienna.
First, I always like to clarify that in every administration, it does not matter if someone commits a serious removable crime, the local law enforcement will notify ICE every state consistently. It happens. It's always happened throughout my tenure. However, what happens and what they're asking for in these situations is, for example, if someone gets pulled over for driving without a license or a traffic infraction, at that point, will they do a check because they're partnered with ICE to see if this individual is in the U.S. lawfully, and will they detain that individual? So that's where the disconnect is right there. So typically, if someone's getting detained for a DUI, wouldn't always trigger it. Now shoplifting does because of the new act. But it would be a serious removable crime. They would automatically notify ICE. Now the complaint is what's happening is that if someone has a simple traffic infraction, they won't be detained, and that's what their concern is. And that's one of the easier ways for ICE to encounter individuals and to increase the number of people they're deporting, right? Because that's what they're running up against right now, is trying to get this number up. And so what you find is in New York, for the most part, there are one or two counties that cooperate, I believe, and also in New York, you have the green light law. So because everyone, regardless of your immigration status, you're allowed to drive, it's harder to have probable cause or reasonable suspicion to stop someone that's driving to check their immigration status, right? Whereas in some states, they don't allow individuals to drive who don't have immigration status. So when someone gets pulled over and they don't have a license, they're automatically detained, taken into the police office, taken into the office, fingerprinted, and then they can notify ICE. And that's why those partnerships are so important to ICE.
JP?
I see this playing out in a couple ways. One is immigration, as Sienna was discussing, and also in education. I think in New York State, education department said that they would not comply with federal orders to eliminate DEI. And so that has put New York State and New York City's federal education funding at risk. I think New York City gets about 6% of their education funding from the federal government. It's about $2.2 billion per year. And this will, I imagine, be fought out in the courts as to whether that is legal or not. But in the meantime, it is, politically, I think it's two edges of a sword. One is Democrats will be able to say, look, the federal government is cutting funding, and we're going to blame this on members of Congress, Mike Lawler, Nicole Malliotakis, Claudia Tenney. We need to get rid of these members of Congress. The other case to be made that the Republicans will say is, well, Democrats are giving up funding because of, what many regard as unpopular policies of DEI and illegal immigration. Like Bernie Sanders was out 2 weeks ago saying basically nobody likes illegal immigration. And they said, is there one thing that Trump has done that you agree with? And he says, yes, the fentanyl at the border and tamping down on illegal immigration. And that's what, that's Bernie Sanders, who's certainly on the left of of the Democratic Party, but you're going to see this on different issues of the federal government is going to try and cut funding everywhere they can, especially to blue states, California, Illinois, New York, and how it's fought out in the courts. Sienna, do you have a perspective on how it might get, you know, viewed by the courts?
Well, that's the ultimate question, because it comes down to, if Congress allocated those funds, does the executive branch have the right to stop and not execute the passage of those funds? And that's one of the most important questions for this administration, because it's a lot of what they're doing.
Where this differs, I mean, all of it's bad to me, but the thing that concerns me is when we talk about what you just described is with, say, FEMA money. Well, okay, so you have a storm in the blue state, you're not going to get anything. You have the same, a similar storm in the red state, and the FEMA funds will go. I mean, those are relatable, right? In the sense of, because you're holding up the money.
But the question is, if Congress has allocated these funds, right?
Yes.
To FEMA, for them to, and then FEMA gets the funds to execute, does the president, who's in charge of these agencies, have the right to stop that execution based on the fact that you're violating some sort of federal, well, for DEI, he's holding to the Supreme Court decision. So he's saying it has to be in adherence to that Supreme Court decision. And so we've seen this before, but we have. And I think that's the question that the court is going to have to answer, I guess.
And there's also two separate issues. One is, okay, a hurricane hits New York. Will New York State get the FEMA money? The other question is, okay, FEMA was using billions of dollars to house illegal immigrants in New York City hotels, which the administration clawed back. Will that, you know, how is that going to get sorted out? So there's two issues of a natural disaster or using money to house migrants.
All right. With those questions in the air, we'll take a quick break. We'll be back. We'll finish up on the other side. We welcome your letters. Last chance. panel@wamc.org. I have to be careful when I say last chance. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Last call with this great panel on this Tuesday morning. It is the 8th of April, and we thank you all very much for being with us. Last call for letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you as always. Okay, so where are we? Are we, did everyone have, yes, what? You didn't get to comment, Alex.
Oh,
go
yeah.
Ahead.
Well,
my
I just
apologies.
To,
come on, Alex.
Thank you.
Take the paper. Yeah. I wanted to cede the floor to you people. So I think. Well, you know.
No, I'm still reacting
smart,
to the
smart individuals. I feel like I'm taking a class in the school of life at the moment.
Sienna is so
anyway,
in charge of the show.
Yeah.
This
so, absolutely true. But what strikes me is that, you know, this we've been talking about the ways in which DEI has been demonized by this administration, and how this is manifest in terms of funding of higher education. But we also see this on a kind of a micro level of the grants dispersed by the National Endowments of the Humanities. Several of them, in fact, most of them have been abruptly terminated by the Trump administration. They've all gotten a form letter saying that your project no longer aligns with the agenda of the current administration. So this means that they will not get any additional funds. They will not be able to finish those projects. Some of these projects had to do with the building of infrastructure on campuses. Like, there was a case in the University of Tennessee where they were, it's a $500,000 grant for the building or the finishing building of a humanities center on campus. And that was also, the stipulation was that they would get a matching grant from private donors. All of a sudden, that project, which is being built as, or was being built as we speak here, is now completely off the table, and it's not just not clear, you know, how they're going to be able to finish that. People in my field, this in the field of Eastern European Eurasian studies, have been fallen afoul of this new policy. The Harvard University or Ukrainian Research Institute had a project of translating texts from contemporary Ukraine. Now that has been abruptly terminated. And so essentially that center, which is kind of semi-autonomous from the university, is now scrambling for private donors to sort of fill the balance of the money they're not now getting.
And I mean, and what's the remedy, right? The university could sue to see if they had the right to pull it back. But then if they sued, does the Trump administration come after them for DEI or what have you? Like you see what's happening with Colombia, which is the ultimate test case for the Trump administration. And do these universities want to deal with the litigation costs that come with going against the Trump administration? So it's just this never-ending cycle.
Right. And not only that, the letter denying these people the remaining funds for their NEH grants, it stipulated that the Trump administration reserves the right to audit the money already spent. So in theory, universities and colleges and even individual faculty members and public schools who are involved in these projects that they receive money for, they might be asked to give that money back if it doesn't conform to the current criteria that are valued by the administration.
Thank you, Alex. We received a letter. I'm just joking.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Sorry about this.
So just to take this one step further, but does it not make sense, just knowing human nature, that so we're talking about grants that are currently in motion, but that it would certainly have an effect on what grants will be sought in the future if you know you have to go through all of these hoops?
Oh, certainly. I think there's no question about that. And it's also like the topic areas of the grants. I mean, this is going to be, radically, affected, Anyway.
Yeah. And what impact that has on the work that would be done, could be done, should be done.
What I will say is, the U.S. had turned itself kind of into the think tank for a lot of countries. Mm. A lot of individuals came to the U.S. to do research. Mm. And that's really, really where we made our money, is being the intellectuals behind a lot of this, technology and everything else, while there's more manufacturing jobs abroad or other things such as that. But what you're seeing is a chilling effect at universities. If they're not able to do the research, less people, international students, are coming in because they're afraid of whether their freedom of speech will, whether they'll be removed from the country. And so we're seeing this chilling effect happening at the higher education institutions.
There's no question about that.
Final topic for this morning, and then we will have officially gotten through all of them, which is really good for us.
Never happens.
No, we don't usually do that. So congratulations to all of you for making that happen. I wanted to there was an interesting article, I thought, and in my mind, it brought several things to mind. And one of them is okay, why now? But that is the question of a Democratic war room that is being launched, a room, if you will, to counter Trump and Republicans. Why now? Where were you, I guess? But the effort includes working with influencers who can connect with hard-to-reach voters and comes as Democratic voters urge leaders to fight harder against the Trump administration. The Democratic National Committee is launching a new effort to push back on President Trump's agenda with an aggressive rapid response operation to counter misinformation from the administration, while also driving the daily Democratic message through an expansive network of micro-influencers who may have a smaller but more devoted following on social media. How could they not have had this in place from the very beginning, JP?
Well, I would say that they have always had a rapid response room. I would say that they're kind of relaunching it. Each, you know, Kamala Harris's campaign certainly had a rapid response room. And the tough thing is that the National Party, when their president, when they don't have a president in power, the National Party doesn't really have a cohesive message. It's basically anti-incumbent. Mm. And each, you see Cory Booker is making his own noise. You see Gavin Newsom is making his own noise. You see Stephen A. Smith, the sportscaster, he's announced that he's also looking at 2028. What I think that
oh, the furrow in Sienna's brow. Yes, go ahead.
But what I hope this rapid response room is really a focus on the economy and the effect of tariffs. While these other issues that we've been talking about, immigration and DI, while they're important issues, they are net, you know, they're challenging issues to win swing state voters on illegal immigration and DI. You're going to win swing state voters by focusing on the negative effects that Donald Trump is having on the economy in terms of jobs, in terms of cost increases, in terms of housing, in terms of education funding, in terms of healthcare funding. It has to be, in my view, an economic message coming out of the National Democratic Party. And any breath or tweet or message or interview where you're not talking about the economic damage of the administration is a moment that you are not making progress in terms of winning 2028.
And of course, bring on the micro influencers. So we are out of time. My thanks to everyone for being with us this morning. You're all wonderful, and I appreciate you being here. Sienna, Alex, JP, thank you. We'll be back right after this.